Hi, everyone. I'm Kristen, and this is Carla.
Hi.
Join us as we explore origin stories and fun facts, or something. All right, we are back with a normal episode again where we each have one topic.
Yeah.
And hopefully have some answers. I have to say that after doing that, the dogs one and having to do the research for all of that, when I chose my topic for today, I was like, oh, this is so straightforward. It makes every other topic that I'm researching seem so much easier and straightforward.
Yeah, I thought that too until...
Oh, no.
It will never be easy for me. And I checked out so many times. I was like, okay. Like, I looked up a lot of stuff, right? Because it was one of those things where it was like a lot of fact checking, right? Where I'm like, nothing is reliable. And I'm like, I'm going to get away from Wiki and I'm just going to go with this timeline.
Yeah.
That web page was wrong in so many ways, like blatantly wrong. And I'm like, why? And I'm like, this is my only timeline. Like,
oh my gosh.
So let's just say.
I know, that's the worst. The worst is when you choose a source and you're like, okay, I'm going to kind of use this like as my anchor source and like fill things in from there and see, because they seem legit or whatever. And then you come across something that they're so blatantly wrong about where you're like, oh,
I know.
No, wait a second.
Oh my gosh. Okay, side note, because it wouldn't be our show or me if I didn't complain a little bit, but the complaining show.
With Carla, starring Carla.
Yeah. So I went to the dermatologist today, and can I just say, okay, so it wasn't anything serious, but like I had this like bump on my nose and I was like, oh, this isn't normal. Can you check it out? And they checked and they're like, oh yeah, it's like precancerous. So let's like get that like burnt off kind of thing, like the nitrogen, liquid nitrogen thing, or whatever the heck they use. And he's coming at me with this like freezing thing and I'm just like, oh, get away from me. But like, and it was so uncomfortable. And then they funneled me off, like they shuttled me off to the pharmacy. They're like, here, get some antibiotic ointment to prevent any kind of thing. And I'm thinking, so precancerous, what does that even mean? And you're giving me a preventative antibiotic? And then I looked around me and everyone that was in, had been in the waiting room with me was waiting in that pharmacy.
No
and two
way.
Of the gentlemen, because it was such a small place that I couldn't help but hear the instructions, got the same thing.
Oh.
They got the same instructions and everything. And I was like, it just seemed like such a racket. Like, as soon as there's a pharmacy and a clinic, like, I know doctors have to make money.
But that was exactly like, remember that dentist we went to that was by your house years ago?
Right.
And every single one, every single person that ever went to that dentist, he recommended getting a mouth guard so that you stopped grinding your teeth.
Yeah. Like the night guard thing. Yeah.
Every single person.
Yeah, it's the same to this day.
Yeah.
Mind
like,
you,
don't
I
worry,
do
it's
grind
covered
the hell
by
out
insurance.
Of my teeth.
I mean, I do too, but.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
No, dentists are a whole other ballgame. Where as soon as they clue into the fact that you have insurance, they just are like on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They know how to use your money.
It's a system, right?
Yeah. And but it's just like, I'm thinking, really, like, did you have to make this appointment worthwhile? So, I don't know. I don't like being treated like.
Not
oh, I
cancer.
Don't even know if that's a thing. Like,
it is a thing, but it's like,
oh,
not.
I'm not worried at all.
Yeah, no, I don't think you should be.
Like, I literally feel like, because they didn't even do like a, what's it called? Biopsy or whatever?
Biopsy, yeah.
So
he was just like eyeballing it.
He was. He took like a little magnifying thing. And he's like, yeah, I'd say it's precancerous. And I'm like, okay. And then, yeah, it's just like, I didn't like how I felt afterwards.
Oh, I hate
and
that.
And I felt like I didn't take advantage of being there because I had to be referred. So I was like, well, do I mention all my other skin problems and stuff? And but I was like, I don't want to.
You know what's crazy
but,
is that when I've been to the doctor and I'm like, okay, I'm going to write down a list because I get so flustered like in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And because they are kind of guiding the thing. And I mean, especially here in Canada, like, yes, we have free healthcare, but at the same time, they get paid by how many patients they have. So
my appointments are booked as 5 minutes. They're literally five minutes.
We get 10 minutes. So it's like 10 minute appointments. You're only allowed to talk about one thing in your appointment.
Yeah.
Generally. So But with my doctor, I tried to slip a few other ones in there. I'm like, just quickly, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
like,
this I always list. Do the just quickly, yeah.
Yeah. And she's like, yeah, that's fine. And she's basically like pushing me out the door. I'm like, yeah. I feel like I got nothing. So if you yeah. actually need to get a few things checked, you basically have to make like 3 or 4 appointments mm-hmm. to get all yeah. of it covered. But even then, I feel so rushed and so like, it's this frantic thing.
Yeah.
I hate
and it's
that.
So devastating because it's like, it doesn't help that doctors are often dismissive. They just had a news story mm-hmm. about like how young women especially are dismissed. And I'm like, yeah. you know. So they're so dismissive. Just mm-hmm. they take one look at me and they assume that I know nothing about like, you know, diets or something, for example, because mm-hmm. my weight has fluctuated my whole life. Right. And I get so annoyed because I'm like, don't just make assumptions.
Like, yeah.
It's just, you know, it's and then or they think I'm being argumentative when I'm asking a question.
Yeah.
I'm like, but I'm just curious. Like, you can say yes or no if you don't want to answer this question.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but that's the thing when they tell us, like, oh, the onus is on the patient to, like, get a second opinion
yeah.
or whatever. It's
but
like,
they're all on
okay,
the
but
defensive.
It's so hard.
All, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that offensive or defensive when they're just ready to, like, fight right away and, you know, kind of wash their hands clean of things? Like, I get it. They could be sued or this or that, but, like...
But here, we don't
can
even
be nice
really
about
do
it.
That very much. I don't think, like, suing people is a big thing
yeah,
here.
I don't know. Is it?
Unless it's, anyway. Like, you know, some botched surgery or something like that.
And how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm trying to think of anything that's happened in my life. It's not raining this morning, so we went to play tennis, which was lovely. And I won one game out of 6.
Why is that so funny? Like, we used to play tennis as kids, right? Just at the campground. But, like, I
there's
just
tennis
don't think of tennis
everywhere
as a Canadian
here.
Thing. Oh, well, there's tons. Even here.
Greg grew up playing tennis. Like, he played a lot of tennis. Because, okay. of course, in South Africa, they can play it basically year-round. So it's a much bigger sport there.
Yeah.
But so he really loves it. And I was like, well, I liked it when I was a kid and mm-hmm. we played it, you know, in gym class or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's tennis courts everywhere here. Like there's one in our neighborhood we can walk
oh,
to.
Nice.
And there's a bunch, you know, around us. Right. So we're like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
cool. Let's just buy some cheap rackets at Canadian Tire and like go and play. And it's been so fun. We've gone for like the last few weeks. We try to go every weekend, but it's been really rainy the last little bit. So
oh, you should invent a new sport. Rain tennis.
Yeah, exactly.
Get your like sticky shoes on.
Well, and this morning we went to the courts by our place and we were like sitting in the car just like because Greg got some Tim Hortons for breakfast. We're so Canadian. Like this is every how many Canadian
know,
things
Canadian
can I mention?
Tire,
Canadian
Tim
Hortons,
Tire, Tim Hortons. Can I make yeah, I'll be the translator. Canadian Tire is a like hardware home goods type store.
It's the best.
And Tim Hortons is a donut coffee shop.
Yeah. It also the best. I mean not as good as it used to be, but still.
Yeah, it's not fresh, but it's still great.
Yeah. And so we're sitting there like just drinking our coffee and like chatting and whatever in the car parked right by the tennis court. And just as we were about to get out, these people yeah. walk onto the court like from the opposite side.
Oh,
and I was like, no. Rejected.
Oh.
So we're like, okay, let's go for a quick walk in the neighborhood. And then we'll see, like, because
yeah.
they weren't that good, just like we're not that good. But, like,
oh.
I'm like, maybe they'll only last for like 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And by the time we're back from our little walk, they'll be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they were still there. They were like digging in. They were just like talking, analyzing their swings and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, okay, they're here for a while. Let's just go. So we went and found these other tennis courts, and they
yeah.
were gorgeous.
Ooh.
They you have like a water
in
view
in some like restricted neighborhood.
Yeah, probably. Well, it was we were on there when it's like supposed to be the seniors time, the seniors
oh.
thing, but it's off season so nobody's out there anyway.
Oh, okay.
But we had like these water views, mountains right
Ooh.
There. There's birds were chirping.
Aww.
We're cut like surrounded by all these trees and stuff. I'm like, this
yeah.
is gorgeous. Let's
oh,
stay here.
Nice.
So we might
oh my
make
gosh.
That our now our regular spot.
They should
we
almost
go.
Have like somewhere where you can like figure out your levels, like a tennis club or something, and that where you could like offer, like if you encounter a situation like that
mm-hmm.
in the wild, where like you could say, hey, do you want to play doubles? Because that could be kind of fun.
We could have. Greg said, he's like, we could play doubles with them. And I was like, I am not that good. That would be really embarrassing for me. And then I saw that like the lady in that couple, she wasn't that good either. And I'm like, why, we could make it work, but I'm like so not that good that it's like, it's so inconsistent that even with just Greg and I playing a game back and forth.
Can we please play doubles with these competent people?
Can I please play with someone else? Hey, I kicked his butt once in one game and I like, I really, we had a really long one game.
You actually did or that he didn't let
you
win?
It's true. No, he didn't. I told him he's not allowed to let me win. He was initially. He's like, oh, I'll just hit it here. I'm like, stop it. We have to legitimately play. Otherwise, I'll never push myself to get better because I just know I'll win if I suck anyway. So, no, it was a legit win. Good. Yeah.
Side note about the weather. It's been 19 degrees here for the last two days. Sunshine. Yeah. Everything's melting finally. There's just rivers of like melting snow. Like
19 degrees.
19. That doesn't, you guys, it's, I know it's March and it's probably hot for a lot of people, right?
It's not that hot here. It was 5 degrees.
Yeah, in Canada, like, you know, in the mid range, especially like up higher, right? It's never, like in Alberta, it's never really that warm, but it was glorious. Oh. So I'm in heaven over
go
here.
Go outside and just like lie in the sunshine.
I took
just
so many walks yesterday. I was like not. That's why my research is in shambles, everybody, because I was getting much needed vitamin D. And
Yeah. Wow.
But
that's awesome.
But I'm still fatigued. I'm fatigued again. I'm like, no. Uh-oh. I'm ready to kick things over. But how can you be mad when there's sunshine and birds, right?
See, it makes such a difference. It's crazy how much difference sunshine makes. Like, it's insane.
But even, like, nice scenery, like how you guys had for, you know, with the tennis court, right? Like, mountains and water. Like, how nice is that?
I know. It makes a huge difference.
Fuming steam coming out of your ears because you hate, like, losing.
No, I was good this time, but the last time we went, it was not good.
Oh, no.
I might have had a couple meltdowns, you guys. I was not in very good mental space, emotional space, and then I sucked.
I'm such a sore loser, like, when I can't do something.
You are a very sore loser.
Big time. I try not to be, especially with my nephew. I have to teach him, like, you can't be, but...
Yeah.
Boy, oh,
nobody's more of a sore loser than your sister, though. I was going to say your younger sister. She's not younger than you.
No.
Okay, let's get started. Who goes first this week?
Oh,
you go first, I think.
Me. We did. Okay.
I think it's you. Because before we did the together one.
Yes, you're right.
I was first, I think.
Yeah.
Sucker.
Okay, you guys, I finally did it. Okay. And my research is questionable at best, so let's sit down and enjoy my facts. My facts. Get it? Today we're doing the history of... I'm so scared you did this. Vending machines.
No, I didn't do it.
Okay, good. Okay.
Yes, finally, because it's been on my list for forever, and I think we've mentioned it in like four episodes.
Yeah.
So, yes. Okay, good. Because I've looked at it a couple times, and I'm like, no, that could be a danger zone, so don't do it. Okay, I'm glad that you did it.
I finally did it.
I can see why you were scared, though, because that is something we easily could have done together.
Yeah, and we were both kind of like, just... tired and the, you know, all the stuff. And so I was like, maybe we're both going to do it.
Okay. Yes, so in case finally get to know. Okay.
Yeah. So in general, like vending machines, anything is basically a vending machine. But the ones I'm talking about are the vending machines that are like automated machines that distribute products, right?
So, right.
Like, I don't know, whatever. Okay. This is not
where you
starting
put the money
well.
In. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's going to automatically give you something for your money.
Yeah, exactly. So at this point, they sell anything and everything, basically, particularly in Japan, which I'll get to later.
Awesome.
But we mostly know them for dispensing snacks and soda pop today, right? Like you go to a like lunchroom or a store and there's like big fat vending machine in your face, right? Back in the day, you inserted coins or cash. But now you can use credit cards, debit cards, special tokens, that kind of thing.
Whoa, yeah. I haven't used a vending machine in such a long time.
I know.
That's cool. Remember all those years like at university or whatever where we're like, we don't have any cash with us if we wish that they would take cards. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know, right? Okay. So, the earliest form of the vending machine was designed by, I don't know if it was actually made, but designed by a guy named Hero of Alexandria. Also known as Heron of Alexandria. He was born in Alexandria in Roman Egypt to Greek parents. So the Greek parents came, like, to Egypt.
What? So long ago.
Uh-huh. He was born in 10 AD. He died around 60-ish, so 70 AD.
Can you imagine if that was your birthday? Like, right? What year were you born? 10.
Yeah. And Jesus is like, yeah, vending machine. Jesus, he wasn't alive. Like,
Jesus. That's how they, what they ate for the Last Supper. There's a vending machine in the background. None of this lines up. That's okay. It's all fake anyway.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So back to Herod. I want to call him Heron, but it's Hero, whatever. Some say he was the greatest experimenter of antiquity.
Oh.
And people are all like, you guys, nobody's talking about this poor guy, but he was apparently amazing.
Yeah. Why do some of those people get so ignored?
Well,
right?
A lot
everybody
of stuff
talks
was,
about Da Vinci.
I'll explain it. Like, a lot of his stuff was lost in the big fire. So he taught at the Great Museum. I don't know what that's, I'm saying that right, of Alexandria. Mm-hmm. And apparently the library of Alexandria was attached to this complex. So remember what happened with the library of Alexandria? It, like,
I don't remember.
When they were conquered or something like that, then the whole fire was, like, destroyed.
Right.
I mean, the whole
they
library
destroyed
was destroyed.
All the knowledge or whatever, right?
Yes. And then the awesome Arab scholars were like, quick, write everything down. It wasn't quite like
as
that.
As it's burning, it's on fire?
You guys, this is so painfully bad. Okay.
That's great.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice too. Okay. Okay, so he had lecture notes that were kept there, but again, they were destroyed. So the only thing that saved is from the transcriptions that we just were joking about. He was into studying the uses for air, steam, and water pressure. He was, like, a mathematician, a physicist. He solved all these engineering problems. He was
cool.
An engineer as well. He might have invented up to 80 machines, but apparently only a few were constructed in his lifetime.
Oh, my gosh.
He wrote about a steam-powered device. Keep in mind that the actual, like, steam engine wasn't invented until way, way, way later by James Watt. Right?
Like, almost 2,000 years later, like,
right?
What, 1,800 years later or something?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, but he made, like, a kind of, like, a crude steam
engine
sort of thing.
You know what would be so cool is if this guy was actually a guy, like, from the future that came to the past. Like, it's Michael J. Fox or something, and he's like, hey, guys, I'm going to invent this.
Check it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then someone else comes back to that same time with a, like, computer, and he's dejected in the corner.
Yeah, and then he, like, burns all his own stuff because he's feeling so dejected and mad. This took a turn.
So, he also invented a sort of fire engine cart contraption thing that, like, was on a cart, like, wheelie cart that you could move around and, like, shot water out using hydraulics. So it was, like, this stream of water.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. One of his most famous inventions is the wind wheel. It was like a mini windmill. Like, mini little guy.
Yeah.
Again, windmills would appear over, like, a millennium later. So he's way ahead of that. This little windmill would force air, like, through a series of pipes. And basically, like, I'm just going to say it was a wind-powered organ. Like, musical organ.
No way.
So it's debatable if it really sounded nice or not.
That's what he used it for.
I know, right? But it's mainly considered to be the first deliberate use of wind power for a man-made machine. So,
cool. Holy cow.
This is my favorite. And I am going on a bit of a tangent. I don't care.
Who cares? This guy's
He designed an automatic door opener. Again, designed. I don't know if he actually was able to make it happen.
Yeah.
That was meant for temple doors. He had a whole steam and, like, pulley situation that would have made it look like the doors were just, like, opening on their own.
Oh,
like, this whole kind of, like, holy, like.
That is awesome.
And I was thinking, like,
no way.
Well, that's theatrical. What's with this guy? And apparently he created, like, a mechanical puppet show. And so he was just, like, having a blast, apparently.
I love that all of his inventions, Egypt. I mean, not all of them, I'm sure, but, like, the majority of his inventions are for, like, playful things or stuff that's not necessarily super practical. Like, an organ, you're going to use that function, like, for an organ or
but
for...
But then a steam engine kind of thing, and then a fire engine.
Yeah, the fire engine's good. Like, that was practical at least. But man, that's hilarious. I love it. He must have been such a funny character.
Okay, but so can you imagine how a vending machine might fit in to any of this? Do you have any ideas? I don't know how you'll guess.
Selling puppets? No.
The market was just like ready for puppets, apparently. Yeah.
Everyone needs a puppet on every corner.
It was a holy water dispenser. Sorry, you're laughing. It was a holy water dispenser.
No.
Yeah.
Oh.
Again, I don't know if it was actually made, but it was designed to work on its own, and it was coin-operated.
Oh, my gosh.
So someone named Maggie Malik, she wrote a fun article about the first vending machine, and she cites Smithsonian, and they explain how it works. So a person puts a coin in a slot at the top of a box. The coin hits a metal lever, so it's like a little balance beam.
Yeah.
On the other end of the beam is a string tied to a plug that stops a container of liquid. As the beam tilts from the weight of the coin, right, the string mm-hmm. lifts the plug and dispenses the desired drink until the coin drops off the beam. So it's like a little lever coin, you know, the offset.
So depending on how it falls, it could be somebody, like, doesn't get as much holy water or somebody gets less, right?
It sounds like there was, like, a pan and it was all very controlled. Like,
okay,
so
cool. That
the coin would hit the pan. Like, more kind of, like, crude. So it was just, like, plop, water kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's science with Carla. Plop, water. So in that same article, John Humphrey, a professor of Greek and Roman studies at the University of Calgary.
Yeah, Calgary.
Yeah. Says the machine was devised because people were taking more holy water than they were paying for.
And that would seem to be such a problem. Oh my God. Hey, he's a problem solver, this guy.
Right?
He's my hero.
He's kind of amazing. Yeah. All right. So we go from antiquity to the 1600s. You guys, there's nothing out there except in actual, like, proper
Because
books.
Everything burned down and apparently it didn't exist.
No,
nobody
like, there's
could
books
recreate
on vending machines and stuff. And I'm like, I'm not going to read. So the only mention, you go from hero to 1615, a very specific date for some reason.
Whoever, so non-specific, nothing at all to 1615.
Yeah, and not even like an invention date. It's just in 1615, tobacco was sold in taverns in England, like, through vending machines. So you'd use a penny to unlock this, like, brass box kind of machine thing. It would, like, open. The coin would, like, make the door open. You'd fill your pipe with however much tobacco you needed. Then you'd close the door again. So you'd have to be supervised by, like, the...
I was just going to say, I'm like, that's quite the honor system that they're going by there.
Right? And we'll get into a little bit of the honor box system kind of situation. Okay, so most outlines make a brief note of a guy named Richard Carlyle at this point, but I kind of wanted to get into it a little bit more.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, we're going on another little...
Let's do it.
...journey. So 1822... Sorry, it says 82, but I know it's 22.
I was like, ooh, big number? Am I supposed to react in some way?
Quick! Why was that date? He was a tinsmith. But at some point, I think he was laid off or something, and he had to, like, basically peddle his wares on the streets or something. So he attended these political meetings at the time because he's like, this sucks. Why aren't all of us working? And, you know, and so he was actually peddling, like, these political writings too. So he said that he walked 30 miles for a profit of just 18 pence a day.
Okay.
So he was really struggling, right? In 1817, he started a publishing company with the printer named William Sherwin. Okay, isn't Sherwin Williams a paint thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this said William Sherwin, and I'm like, this is weird.
So Carlyle his son, wanted... Sherwin Williams.
Yeah, that's how they named their kids.
Yeah.
So this guy, sorry if I call him Robert, his name is Richard Carlyle, wanted to make political texts like Tom Paine's The Rights of Man available to everyone. So he actually split the writing into like small sections and he made pamphlets that he could sell to the poor. So he was really like, get the word out, right?
That's clever, yeah.
And it wasn't to take advantage of them, like so that they would buy these pamphlets from him. It was
He's like, handing them out for free.
No.
Oh.
He was charging, but like...
Oh, I see. Okay.
He did want to get the word out.
Right? Yeah.
So his life was super radical. There's this whole thing. Just check him out online. It's really fun. So this little note, I just have to throw it in there. So he might have sucked in some ways, but apparently he advocated for equality between the sexes.
Oh, really?
He published a book, 1817 or 19, I don't know when, but advocating birth control and the sexual emancipation of women.
No way.
But then I started laughing when I wrote that down because I'm like, he clearly saw the advantage
of
sexually liberated women on birth control, right? So I was laughing to myself. And then at the end of the thing, it was like, he had a mistress as well. I'm like, well, there we go.
I was just going to say, of course he wants them to be liberated. I'm surprised more men don't want that.
I know. Yeah. And birth control. I'm like, you guys come on. Anyway, this Richard Carlyle guy invented a book vending machine.
Oh, right. That's where you mentioned it in your other one, your paperback.
No, that's different.
Oh.
Not this guy anyway.
Okay.
Okay, I'll read this blurb. This particular machine had a dial that could be turned to a certain book title, and upon inserting the appropriate amount of money, the book would be dropped into a pickup shelf in the lower half of the machine. The purpose of this machine was to avoid censorship laws, which prohibited the selling of certain blacklisted books.
Cool.
Carlyle believed that if a machine sold the banned books, so again, that Thomas Paine one, I think, was, or Tom Paine was banned or something.
Right, because it's like political stuff, and the politicians at the time were like, no, that goes against what we're doing.
Yeah, so he's hoping basically to like, well, they can't throw me in jail. This, I'm not selling the book. It's this the vending machine.
Oh, that's clever.
But that didn't work, and he still went to jail.
Okay.
But it's, yeah.
But still, I like that he tried.
So it's 1820, so we won't see book vending machines again, really, until, I mean, there might have been here and there, right?
Okay.
But, like, we won't see it until, like, the 1920s.
Okay.
So now we go to 1860s. We're going to fly through the time now, okay?
Yeah.
So some guy named Simon Denham was the guy, first one to create a fully automated vending machine.
Oh.
I'm
what, 1860s, you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
1867. So... I guess it's like where you don't have to like open a door or something and help yourself to like, you know, that like that tobacco machine.
Right.
I couldn't. No, you guys, it's not like this is a popular topic. I couldn't figure out how his was fully automated. But anyway.
Okay.
He was awarded British patent number 706 for his stamp dispensing machine. And some people said it was super popular and people went wild and they're like, wow, stamps. And then other people said that it took a while for these vending machines to even catch on. So,
okay.
Maybe because it was like super heavy. It was like a cast iron thing the size of like a man and maybe it just wasn't really profitable. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, 1880s, that's where all the articles say that the first modern machines were made.
Okay.
Right? I don't know why they ignore Simon.
That is like, all of this is so much earlier than I ever would have anticipated it being.
I know.
It's crazy.
So a lot of people say that the first vending machine sold postcards.
Okay.
I was like, okay.
To go with the stamp machine that already existed.
Yeah, probably. And England in 1880s. So I had the when, where, and why, but no mention of the who's. Because everybody's like... England, stamps, 1880s. I'm like, okay, fine, I get it, but who?
Yeah.
So finally I clued in that this name that kept coming up in other articles was connected. So I'm stupid. So Percival Everett, he's
the
main kahuna, I know, of the modern vending machines.
Okay.
So 1883, he basically... like the Everett machine, as it's known, was an improvement on previous vending machines. So old ones required customers to provide their own coins or notes to buy items from a tray located inside the cabinet of the machine. So I'm guessing that's still like the tobacco thing.
Okay.
Again, I don't know what the hell Simon was doing and how it's different, not different, right? But anyway. But Everett's is the first one that was commercially viable.
Okay.
So maybe he did something that was more...
Maybe that other one, because they still had to turn the dial to get it to a certain thing.
So oh, no, that was the book one.
Oh, the book one.
Yeah, the stamp one was... Yeah, maybe
oh,
it
the
was
stamp
a dial
one, right.
thing. Yeah, anyway.
Right, right.
It's a bit messy, you guys. I'm sorry. But anyway, so at the Everett machine became a widespread feature at railway stations and post offices, and it dispensed everything from envelopes to postcards and notepaper.
Okay, so that's very stationary based. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
So that was probably cigarettes, I'm guessing, already, but anyway, maybe not. Anyway, so that's the UK. So what's going on in America? In 1884, there's an article by Louise Tisby. She wrote a nice summary of vending machines. She points out that the first American patent for a vending machine was filed by an Edward H. Heineman in 1884, right? But that machine flopped because it could only dispense one item at a time. I don't know how that's a bad thing.
How is that different from what vending machines do now?
I don't know. She then writes that a Charles Mayer found success with his patented machine that could accept several different coins in payment.
Oh.
So different. Yeah, like, so, whatever. It was the thing. Okay, none of those machines really took off, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though Charles Mayer, his machine, he went to, like, the Chicago World's Fair. It didn't take off, but people were like, vending machines, you say?
I'm going to steal that idea and tweak it slightly and make millions and not share it.
Right? So back in England...
Where's Thomas Edison? He's going to be a bastard about
actually,
it.
Actually, people said he did make a vending machine, yeah, but I was like, I'm ignoring you, Edison. You have enough airtime. Back in England, 1887, we have the Sweetmeat Automatic Delivery Company, which was England's first company to deal primarily with the installation and maintenance of vending machines.
Whoa!
So it's getting huge.
I love their name, too. It's cute.
Guess what? Our old friend is back. 1888. Somebody perfected what was going on out there with all these vending machines, right?
Uh-huh.
He obtained the American patent rights to Everett's machine.
Okay.
And adapted it to sell his Tutti Frutti gum. He wanted to sell gum on the New York train platforms. Do you remember his name?
No, Chiclet. No. I can't.
Thomas Adams Gum Company.
Oh my gosh.
This is a callback to our chewing
Adams,
gum episode.
London chewing gum. 37 years old. Oh, New York. Yeah, whatever.
So he was on it, right? He perfected it. He's
my
like,
gosh.
Let's get these vending machines out there. That's why I mentioned that vending
business.
Machine.
That's right.
Yeah. So 1888, it's like people are loving it. 1897 already, mm-hmm. with the help of Pulver Manufacturing Company, Adams wanted to engage the consumer like more. So some of the machines were enhanced with automated tiny figures that would move when an item was purchased. So it's kind of like, let's make this more engaging. I'm like, I don't think they cared. But anyway.
Just sell us a product, damn it.
Yeah. In 1907, I think he was the first one to make a gumball machine. So a gumball machine is technically a vending machine.
Oh, yeah, because you put the money in. And then it comes out.
Yeah. Anything you put money in and anything that dispenses. What? So.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry.
Kristen's playing some video games over there. So what about drink vending machines? 1890s. Drink dispensing machines date back to the 1890s. The first beverage vending machines were installed in Paris, France, and they sold beer, wine, and liquor. Vending machines began distributing soda into cups in the early 20s in the States.
I was just going to say, were they the ones that actually poured into something?
Yeah.
Or were they in bottles already?
No, like poured into, it looks like.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy. Could you imagine going to a place and just getting like a cup full of wine or beer or whatever? Like the crappy coffee? That would be hilarious.
I know. I think that's what it was. Because they lead into unless the soda ones are the first ones. Who cares?
Oh, yeah,
who cares about history?
Yeah, yeah.
who
cares?
The 1890s generally saw vending machines just taking place root everywhere in Europe. So 1893, the German chocolate manufacturer Stahlwerk is noted for setting up 15,000 vending machines, first to sell chocolate, then gum, cigarettes, matches, and soap products. So they were just
they were doing all of it. Mm-hmm. Which makes sense, like all the little basics that you need, kind of like a convenience store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1912, there was that German publishing company that I mentioned in my paperback thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
I think it was Reclam or something. Believe it or not, I was too lazy to open my own notes. They had a book vending machine.
It's There's crazy, though, that other guy did the pamphlet thing first.
Right. Yeah.
Like, that's pretty impressive that he did it, like, what, almost 100 years before them, like 90 years before them or whatever.
It's crazy.
That's so cool.
By 1937, one publisher was really getting into book vending machines, sorry. Our friends at Penguin Publishing.
Right.
That came up in the Penguin thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So they came up with their own vending machine, right? I can't believe I didn't see this name when I was researching Penguin Books. They called the machine the Penguincubator.
Oh, my gosh. That is so awesome. I love that so much. It's also stupid, but I love it.
I know. So apparently people debate the existence of this machine, but they say there is at least one, or was at least one, installed near Charing Cross Station in, is it Charing Cross? In London, which cheesed off local booksellers. So they probably have record of booksellers complaining about this penguin incubator.
Of course, because they'd be like, don't make it more convenient for people to do this. Oh my gosh.
So there's a whole history of book vending machines. In the 40s, there was one called Book-O-Mat. It had a selection of 50 books that you could buy. Like you could just, for a quarter, you could get a book.
That's awesome.
And people still make book vending machines. Okay, anyway, back to soda. Coca-Cola was the first to vend bottled drinks beginning in 1937. And that's all I have on Coca-Cola
bottled drinks.
And soda.
So before that, any of the drink vending machines were where it just poured out.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, good point. Yeah. So I have just a bunch of modern random facts now. Yeah. I told you this is not very stellar presentation.
Oh, no, I love it. Are you kidding me? This is awesome.
1972, there was apparently the first snack vending machine was made by the Polyvend company.
That's a little bit crazy to me that there's
I think because everything was so specialized. So when you go into like the 40s and 50s, they really were like, it was like one item, like a cigarette.
Okay.
Soda, books. Maybe, and this is the varied snack kind of machine. Where
maybe
you could pick,
also
like,
because they needed snacks that would last a long time. So they were waiting like with preserved foods, like the snack foods that they didn't exist before then, right?
Yeah, because they had like those automats or whatever, which were kind of like cafeterias, where you put your quarter in and you get your hot meal. But there would be an actual working kitchen in the back, like
right. Someone would be filling it up regularly and putting stuff in. Okay,
yeah. So 2006 was the year where vending machines in the U.S. take credit cards. Oh, so that's pretty late, I think.
That's like way earlier than I thought. Just because I haven't ever used a vending machine with a credit card.
Yeah,
maybe I've never been around high end ones before. Only the poor vending machines.
Okay, just some random stuff now. Okay, so newspaper boxes. I don't know if anyone remembers those. They're technically vending machines, and their nickname is the honor box because technically you could like just put a quarter in and take all the newspapers if you wanted.
That's right.
Because they're all just there. You can't just take one.
Didn't even occur to me that, of course, that's how it works.
Yes.
Do you remember how sometimes if it was completely empty, but the display one in the front was?
Yeah.
And you'd have to take that one? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, well, it's here. Of course, it's here. I paid. Yeah. So, yeah, like, I know. And I didn't even realize that everyone really just, and I guess why would people need multiple of the same, like one newspaper, right? Sometimes the only reason I got newspaper was because like I wanted to put it down under my birdcage or for
or we'd actually read it back then because there wasn't anything.
Yeah, the comics.
Else.
Remember comic
like,
page?
Oh my gosh, the comics. It's crazy that they don't have those newspaper vending machines and
I know.
Do newspapers even exist anymore? Like, do people even get them like they used to?
Yes. I think they still
They must sell them exist. I see them like at the, oh, I guess at like the convenience store or whatever, but like not enough that you would have to have like a
thing. Box on every corner. Yeah. And apparently they're more popular in the States and Canada. So if we have any international listeners, it's literally you put a quarter or 50 cents into a box, you open it, take a newspaper, leave the rest of them, close the box, and you're done, right?
Yeah.
Cigarette vending machines were popular since the beginning of time, but only recently was age verification mandatory. Like they didn't even have a way for people to like put their, right? Like,
right.
You have to put your ID card in. And I'm like, oh, yeah, kids could just buy.
I guess that's why a lot of them were found in bars and stuff, though, because in theory, you'd have to be of age to be in a bar.
Oh, that's more. Oh, yeah.
Because I do remember that they had restrictions on those, that at some point they changed a law where they only were allowed to have them in bars. They couldn't have them elsewhere because kids were accessing them.
Yeah.
Cool. That's crazy. I totally, yeah.
There are pizza vending machines, ones that sell frozen caviar, pornography, hot meals, toys, life insurance was sold at one point in vending machines, fishing bait, French fries, toilet paper, cars. There's one in Singapore. It's huge, you guys. It's amazing. It dispenses Ferraris, Lamborghinis, like luxury vehicles. I'll say a little bit about it.
Oh my gosh.
So this 2017 article. So customers use a touchscreen on the ground floor to browse the selection of fancy high-end cars. The chosen car arrives within 1 to 2 minutes, and customers can view, test drive, or buy the car. Staff supervises this whole thing, of course, but the car vending machine idea was done in the US and Japan first, but I think it's just, it looks so good, you guys. It's like,
that's so cool. That must be,
you just type in like, Singapore car vending.
Yeah, cool.
It basically, it's like so stupid because it literally looks like one of those life-size Hot Wheels toys.
That's totally what I'm
car
imagining.
Holder thing. Yeah. And it's just this, like, yeah, this tower, but it's actually really pretty too. So it's like, okay.
Yeah, Singapore has some like insane architecture.
I know.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned very early on, Japan is just like on it with vending machines. They're obsessed. One statistic is that there's one vending machine per 23 people.
No way.
That amounts to more than 5.5 million vending machines throughout the country. You can get food, smartphones, SIM cards, underwear. I was kind of laughing about the underwear, but then I thought of like those sanitary napkin vending machines. Those are vending machines in the women's bathrooms. And then like underwear would kind of be clever for women.
But imagine the wrong size, like the wrong one. Like, comes down or whatever from the little coil.
Yeah. Not the kids' underwear. Yeah. And so many things are considered vending machines, right? Like, so we probably think of those big, giant ones with the glass fronts, right?
Yeah.
And like, but, like, candy and gumball dispensers, as I mentioned, newspaper boxes, photo booths, ticket machines, like the ones you see at transit stations or movie theaters.
Oh, my gosh.
Anything that, like, literally shoots something out of it is a vending machine, right?
Oh my gosh. I didn't even think of it. That's crazy. I didn't even think of that. Like the photo booth thing or whatever.
Right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it makes sense.
So recently, the specialization of vending machines is becoming like much more common. So people, you'll see like artwork being sold in a vending machine or like short stories or just really random.
Oh my gosh.
Stuff, right? So my last little note is just like some people claim that there's so many of them because obviously they're convenient, but also they're low cost. But when you start talking about like the big refrigerator ones, like the snack machines or pop machines, right? Like if they have to be refrigerated, that's a whole, like, it doesn't sound that cheap actually. It sounds kind of like a bit of a nightmare. So if you ever want to get into the vending machine thing, I'm sure it can be lucrative on some level, but I mean, where are you going to put this machine? If you're an operator, you probably have to like give a commission to the store or wherever. And then servicing it is a nightmare.
Yeah.
You have to drive all over the city all the time.
I'm sure for like some of the small ones, though, it is like it makes sense. Like, say, in universities or whatever, where you can have like a few vending machines instead of having an actual corner store.
Usually those big ones, like I know with our high school, you would have a contract with brand specific vending machines. So it'd be like Coca-Cola would provide the machine. So you can't just be a Joe Schmo.
Right.
and operate your own vending machine, right? So I would suggest, and what a lot of people kind of alluded to, is like gumball machines, those kind of, you know, the candy ones, yeah. the ones that you find at Toys R Us, because those bulk things are so cheap to buy.
Yeah.
Like 2 cents per gumball, but you can make 25 cents per gumball, right?
Right.
And they don't expire. You can just basically keep the candy in there for a really long time.
I remember when we went to Zellers, we used to go to Zellers all the time when I was a kid. Yeah. And in the entrance, the doors, between the outside doors and the inside doors, there were all of those like gumball machines, but some were gumballs, some were other candies, some were just like the little toys or like the little rings, like the little balls that had rings and stuff in them.
Those rock candies. Oh my gosh, I always wanted to get the ring.
I always wanted the ring too.
And I never did.
No, we were obsessed with it. And that was the part of the store where my mom was like, no, you guys need to keep walking. Like, it's not happening. We're like, it was a quarter.
Yeah, it was only like, and not even, it was like 5 cents sometimes.
It was 5 cents, remember? Yeah.
Oh man,
we sound old. but it was still so fun. Like, I don't know if they even still have those.
They do at Toys R Us and in the doorway there. But a lot of the stuff is just gross, junky stuff now. Like, it's not
even fun candy. Well, I'm sure it was back then, too.
No, but it was like, we still had some good candies, though.
Right.
Like, actual candies, right? Like, even like, if they were knockoff, we didn't know, but they were still like good, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if they had candy as much. It definitely looked like primarily toys, but I mean, it's Toys R Us.
I think that tends to be a bit more.
And there was a gumball machine there is one at the garden center I go to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
I got candy for my nephew there once, and I'm like, this is crazy.
Oh my gosh. One of my all-time favorite things anywhere is in Amsterdam. They have the hot vending machines.
I'm so jealous.
You'll go, and it's like, you kind of like walk in a little bit, but there's no doors or anything like that. It's kind of like just an alcove, like along the street.
Yeah.
And it's just a wall full of little doors. And you just like, you pick which one you want. You pay for it, obviously. And then you open it up and you pull out your little hot snack. And most of them are some kind of deep fried cheese related thing. They're so good.
Oh my God. So you would just find my like bloated, like comatose body. In this alcove after eating like 900 cheese snacks.
and
fries
so
with the mayonnaise or whatever you guys eat.
Oh my gosh, yes.
No, french fry sauce. What is it? It's not mayo,
sauce.
Is it?
Frites
sauce. Frites sauce.
Yeah.
I never even had it. It sounds good.
It's so good. But so I would always say to my cousins, like whenever we went there, because they would come into Amsterdam with us for the day or whatever. And I'm like, oh, we got to go find like a vending machine. They're like, what? Really? Like, because for them, it's not a big deal at all. And I'm like, we don't have these back home.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have anything like it. It's so cool.
Now we just have like really disturbing and gross. Like, so we've always had convenience stores, but now like with 7-Eleven. They're obsessed with pumping out like full buckets of chicken and like full meals. And it's so gross.
Really?
Like, why would you ever get fried chicken from 7-Eleven, like a gas station?
Know.
I can't. I'm like, not that the actual food places are any better, but it just feels a little more
legit. But you're like,
legit.
That's like a food place. That's their purpose.
That's all they
make
do.
Food.
Yeah.
Not like,
it's disgusting. And
I
you
don't
go
know.
In now and it just stinks like old oil.
No.
And I'm like,
that's weird, because they always had like the old hot dogs roasting there or whatever, like, but it's like they should have drawn the line somewhere. That's also to me like movie theaters now that let you have a whole full meal in the theater. I don't like that.
Me neither, because like what about people with like smell sensitivities? Like I have that.
Yeah.
So sometimes people eat things and it's just too smelly and I'm like, it's distracting.
Yeah.
Although I'll be honest, I'm a party pooper. I do not like popcorn in theaters because A, it sticks to my shoes. Mm. Primarily though, it's the noise of people crunching.
I think eat your popcorn during the previews, like the trailers and stuff in the beginning, but you have to be done making all your noises by the time the movie actually starts.
Fair enough. That's
my
totally
rule.
Legit. Yeah. But people, they just munch and then they get up halfway when they're looking for their
so
seat
annoying.
And they have like their pop, like the ice is rattling and it's like, shut up, eat before you get here. Not to be total Debbie Downer, but.
Should we maybe just not be the ones that go to movie theaters?
Yeah.
Obviously.
I don't. After the bed bug thing, I'm like, I'm done.
Oh no.
I didn't get bed bugs, just saying. The reports of them.
Yeah. You can't go out in public anymore. That was awesome. Oh my gosh. Now we know vending machines. I had no idea they happened so early. Mm-hmm. That hero guy, I want to know all about him. Like, what a fascinating character.
I know.
Oh my gosh. Okay. This week I am doing the origin of chess. Where chess came from.
Dang. And that's good.
Because it started somewhere that I didn't. And it's
no,
funny
it didn't.
Because
it just existed.
No, it's always existed.
Yeah.
It's funny because I just kind of started typing and I was actually going to search some other topic that's been on my list for ages. So I started typing in origin of, and then it came up as one of the
miming
top
typing,
things.
But like your typing is like just pounding on the keys apparently.
It's just my arms that are moving. My fingers aren't moving at all. That is how I
it's
type.
It's true. That's what you're miming. Oh my gosh. I love it.
But it came up as like a thing, origin of chess. And I was like, oh, what is the origin of chess? And I got distracted and started looking at it. And I was like, this is so cool. And then I did it for a topic. And here we are, you guys.
Wow.
Okay.
I'm impressed.
Okay. You're so good at guessing my answers. Every time I've done like, guess where something came from, you always guessed it. So I'm curious if you're going to guess this one.
I won't, but okay.
Where do you think chess started?
Where?
Yeah. Where in the world? Is Carmen San Diego?
Okay, my brain is automatically going either to China or somewhere in like the Arabic sort of region. So okay. That's it. I don't know. I can't
close,
guess.
But no. India.
Oh!
Started in
I think
India.
I knew that at some point.
And I did not know it. I was so shocked because I asked Greg, too, and he said China. And then he said...
See, my brain was pulling me kind
of
like
Russia
towards, you know... Well, not Russia. Nobody...
I know. I'll give him a break, though.
Why? Didn't
poor,
he go to school?
Poor guy. But I think because chess is so associated with Russia,
I know.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Dang. Okay, so the precursor to chess was a game called Chaturanga, which originated in India in the 7th century AD. And it translates...
I've heard that word.
That word. You have heard that word. So it translates into four divisions of the military, like four divisions. So you might know this word very well because it's a common pose in yoga. So the word itself is Sanskrit, and it means, it comes from chatter, which is four, and anga, which is limbs. So it means four limbs. So you're using all four limbs. Yeah. I know when I looked at that, I was like, chaturanga, like, and I went and did a whole deep dive. I'm like, are they somehow connected? Like, did chess, like, or they come from the same thing?
Did they play, like, twister style chess back in the day? Can you imagine yoga chess?
Oh my gosh, yes.
And bend and checkmate.
And downward dog and kick them in the face. So the four parts of the military in this game refers to infantry, cavalry, elephantry, and chariotry.
Get
at that
out.
Point. I know. These later evolved into the modern chess pieces of pawn, knight, bishop, and rook.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God. But why isn't there an elephant?
I know in some versions throughout history, there were elephants still included as some of the pieces.
Mm-hmm. Magical. But it's just a giant piece.
Yeah, it just stomps on the whole thing.
Yeah. I win.
Checkmate. You're done. I killed you all. So Chaturanga was a simulation of war. And aside from the four arms of the military, there was also a king and his advisor.
Ooh.
Right?
And
so you've got
jester?
Those four things. The king and the advisor. Yeah, and a jester for some reason.
Oh, yeah, the jester was the advisor sometimes. I can make up my own game. Anyway.
We should actually. That would be fun. Right. So the game was played on an 8x8 board called an Ashtapada, which was borrowed from an earlier game that was a type of racing game, kind of like backgammon or something similar to that. So Chaturanga didn't even have its own special board. It just was kind of borrowing from other ones. So this early board was not checkered like a modern chess board is. That happens later in history. It had some markings on it that were inherited from other games, but it didn't pertain to the way that they played the game.
Yeah.
So the reason that Chaturanga is considered the earliest precursor of modern chess is because of two key features that are found in all later chess variants. Okay. So one is that different pieces have different powers. So that's unlike checkers or Go, like other similar games like that.
Right.
They have different pieces that have distinct characteristics and things that they can and can't do. And the second point is that victory was based on one piece, the king. So they could either win by getting rid of all of the other pieces except the king, or doing like the checkmate where the king is vulnerable.
Right.
So that's what made chess chess.
Ooh.
So there are some people who talk about, they think that there's a version in China, an early version in China that was actually the precursor to chess, but it's not actually based that way. So other people say that it's actually, that came later, that this, because it wasn't, it's not close enough to what chess is to be considered the precursor to chess. Chaturanga is very much, very similar to chess in those two important ways.
Dang.
Okay, so most of the early accounts of Chaturanga only vaguely talk about the existence of the game or mention some of the pieces used in the game, but almost none of them talk about how the game is actually played or the rules that are associated with it. So they do talk about it, like there are actual instances where they talk about it and talk about certain elements in it, but they don't really talk about like the strategy or any of the rules of it.
Oh, okay.
Because it doesn't seem that the Indians made any record of their games that they played. Because I think they used it very much as just a way to strategize for military. But it was a game, but it was also kind of a way to learn military strategy.
You sunk my battleship. Imagine they used that as actual military strategy.
2A. Remember when we went to watch that in the theaters with that meetup
Don't
group?
Remind me.
That's
worst
crazy.
Movie.
What a flashback to memory there.
Yikes.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So Chaturanga was introduced into Persia from India. And in Persia, it became part of the princely or courtly education of Persian nobility.
Get out of here. Sorry, I was thinking of like,
I will
like
not.
The noble, like, sorry, go on.
What do you
when
mean?
You first asked me, just like the, I immediately thought of like, you know, the kind of noble.
Yeah. And see, it went into Persia. So that was like the Middle East kind of area that you were talking about. So you weren't far off.
Too far off. I mean, there was only so many places it could be invented, but.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. The name got shortened to Chatrang. And the rules were developed a little bit further with the Persians.
Oh. Okay.
And here, players would start calling out Shah, which is the Persian king word for king, when attacking the opponent's king.
Ooh.
And Shah Mat, which is Persian for the king is helpless,
get out
when
of
the
here.
King was attacked and could not escape from attack.
Checkmate!
Yes, these exclamations stuck around in future versions of the game, and it's where check and checkmate came from.
Get out.
The word Shah is also where most of the European names for the game are derived. So that's how it ended up being called chess for us. There's a big evolution there, and there's all kinds of information about how the names kind of evolved. I didn't want to go into it because there's a lot there about it.
And it is what it is, right? Like,
Yeah. But they basically, the Persian saying Shah and Shah Mat were things that were now brought into the game and stayed through the course and kind of got tweaked with each language and each combination of languages and stuff that happened.
Wow.
But it started there.
That's insane.
I thought that was so cool.
That is so, so cool.
Okay, so the Persians were conquered by the Arab Muslims, who were the first to make records of their games of Chaturanga or Chatrang.
Man, they were just recording everything.
They were. So the oldest recorded game was found in a 10th century manuscript, so 900s. AD, and it was played between a Baghdad historian and his pupil. It's so the game spread to the Far East by way of the Silk Road, and it spread into Russia by the Volga-Caspian trade route.
Oh.
So basically...
Oh, that's like, earlier than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
So by 1000 AD, chess was popular in Russia and had spread to China, Japan, and parts of Europe as well.
Oh my gosh.
And it was largely spread because of these traders, and like people just picked it up as they went and they would take it with them. And if you think about it too, because it was kind of a military strategy based kind of thing, it was teaching people good skills. It wasn't just something that people were playing and not learning anything from. So mm-hmm. It wasn't looked down on. Like a lot of religious people at the time often looked down on just playing frivolous games or even right. nobility yeah. or like people were like, you don't waste your time with stuff. But a lot of times they use the excuse of, no, we're learning important strategy. We're learning important things.
Yeah.
Which would allow them to continue playing it.
Oh, man.
So it's at this time, so 1000 AD, that the boards started to be designed with alternating black and white or red and white squares, and they were often made out of fine wood or marble.
Ooh.
The pieces themselves were becoming stylized and intricate again. And I say again because the pieces had been fluctuating between ornate and simple since the earliest time of the Chaturanga game.
Mm-hmm.
The very initial pieces from 600 AD were very simple, but they eventually evolved into figurative sets depicting animals, warriors, and noblemen. The sets that the Muslims used and passed on to other areas were very simple because the pieces were non-representational and made of simple clay or stone. This was because the Islamic faith prohibited making images of living creatures. So mm-hmm. they made very, like, they... They were like, no, mm-hmm. we don't want it to be right. all stylized. We just want it simple.
Right. Ooh.
And this is actually believed to have spurred the popularity of the game at the time because the sets were easier to make.
Oh, yeah.
And redirected the player's attention back to the game itself rather than being distracted by the intricate pieces.
Right.
Because people were kind of like getting a little like, oh, I just want it to pretty. Look fancy, but not really playing it.
Yeah.
Which I think is similar to now where it's like, oh, yeah. you know, they want it to whatever.
I know.
So stylized sets, often adored with precious and semi-precious stones, came back into fashion when the game spread to Europe and Russia. Peter the First, so that's Peter the Great, of Russia had special campaign boards made of soft leather that he carried during military efforts. So, like, people had all these different, like, special boards and special things that they were doing with them at that time.
Just, like, Fabergé eggs just on the board?
Basically, probably. Yeah, I would not be surprised. Okay, so now we jump forward to the time period of the 12th to the 15th centuries. So this okay. time range. So over the centuries, chess evolved pretty slowly, with changes in the rules sometimes taking hundreds of years to be widely accepted. For example, by 1300, the pawn had acquired the ability to move two squares on its first turn rather than only one square at a time as it did in its earliest versions.
Okay.
But this rule as a whole didn't win general acceptance throughout Europe for more than 300 years. Like, it was this, like, fight that had to happen.
That's funny.
And there was also at the time a lot of regional variation between the rules. So depending on what area you were in, they generally were like, okay, we do it this way here, kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
They all had the basic stuff, but then some of the rules would shift slightly between from place to place.
Yeah.
So two major rule changes happened in chess, which became popular after 1475 and really shifted the trajectory of the game.
Okay.
So the first one was that the counselor or advisor to the king, that piece, underwent a sex change and became the queen. So it also gained, by making this change, it gained more mobility on the board, which made this new piece one of the most powerful pieces in chess.
Ooh.
So that was a big shift that happened. This also placed more value on pawn promotion, which added a new dynamic to the game. And I have here, I wrote down, I'm like, I wish I could tell you exactly how that worked, but I can't, so don't ask. But I thought I'd mention it in case people who actually play chess are listening, they would know, oh my God, yeah.
Write to us and explain it.
Exactly. Or don't. That's okay, too.
Yeah, that's true.
There's so much specific information about the actual gameplay.
Oh, that's painful, right? Because it's like, do I try to understand this? And you're like, I'm not going to sit here and figure out chess for the next.
I know. I was like, okay, I'll mention these key ones because they were like a really key shift in it. But yeah. I'm like, that's as far as I'm delving into it. There's so much out there.
Fair enough.
Okay, so the second change was that they changed the elephant piece to be the bishop. And it almost doubled its range of movement on the board. So prior to these changes, a checkmate had been relatively rare. They couldn't make it happen. And games had usually been won by burying the king, which means they're basically just getting rid of all of the other pieces except for the king.
Right.
And that's how they were winning.
Yeah.
Rather than doing a checkmate.
Right.
So the increased pace of the game... these changes increased the pace of the game and they made it much more competitive and just much, I think, more fun to play because there were all these other options that could happen now.
Do you know, because I'm trying to think like queens and stuff, like you had like the whole 1492 business with that queen in, or was she Spain or whatever?
Oh, yeah. I know, I was kind of curious, excuse me, about delving
into... We can check that out for like a mini episode sometime, right?
Yeah, to kind of see if there was a correlation between like the rise in power of women in some way or something like that.
Maybe
some
it was
significance.
Just queens were,
it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting thinking like that change happened because that typically isn't a change that would happen.
Right.
And that so I easily. If that they could have like, changed it to any other character, right?
Yeah, and I kind of wonder where regionally that happened, the queen, because... Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, it could have been.
I could do your research, damn it. No, I'm kidding.
No way. Okay, so during this medieval time in history, there was a huge social value that became attached to the game. It was seen as a prestigious pastime, and it was associated with nobility and high culture.
Damn.
And at this time, they were having ornate chess pieces and boards made again. So it went from being simple to now they're like, okay, let's make it fancy. There were also many books written about chess at this time as well. And keep in mind, this is like the medieval times, so it's very, very early. But already you're starting to see books about chess and chess theory happening already at this time. So, for example, Peter Alfonsi, who was a Jewish, Spanish physician, writer, and astronomer, wrote a book called Disciplina Clericalis, which listed chess as one of the seven skills that a good knight must acquire. At certain points during this time, the Catholic Church tried to ban chess because they thought it was leading to violence and gambling. In the 1300s, there were like a couple of documented acts of violence that took place like around chess games that people were mad that they lost and whatever, right?
Gosh, cracking their like boards over each other's heads.
Exactly, yeah.
That's funny.
But it never quite worked. The ban never worked because the argument of it being a necessary strategic game always won out. Mm. So, like, the Catholic Church, like they do with everything or did with everything in history, they were trying to control what was going on, right?
And, I mean, any kind of implication that, like, a bishop would ever be knocked off the board would probably be, like, enraging to them on some level.
Right, yeah. Okay, so now in the 16th century, so we're in the 1500s now.
Yeah.
Eventually, the game evolved into what we know as chess around the 16th century. So one of the first masters of the modern game was a Spanish priest named...
Spain!
Rai Lopez. Rai?
See? Yeah. I knew it was taking root in Spain. It had to be that darn queen. What the hell was her name?
I know.
Victoria? No.
Victoria
what the hell?
Of Spain. Queen Elizabeth of Spain. Queen
<It's Donna>.
Janice. Yeah, Donna. Okay, so although he didn't invent... So apparently there's an opening move named after him. But he didn't invent it. But he did analyze that move in a book that he published in 1561.
Okay.
So there's a really famous opening move in chess now that people call it, I think, the Rai Lopez or something.
Oh, okay.
But he didn't invent that, but he did talk about it, and he published a book about these moves.
Okay. Isabella, by the way.
Isabella. See, that makes more sense for Spain. Yeah. That's right. And they had that portrait with the dead baby.
Good Lord, what?
Yeah, didn't they? Because what's-his-name was painting all their portraits of them. Whatever, that's not important.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that! Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where they had the baby, but the baby died, and then he had to, had to, like, take it out.
Boy,
of the
you have a good memory. Jeez.
I know, I'm amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, chess theory was so primitive back then that Lopez advocated the strategy of playing with the sun in your opponent's eyes as like a strategy to win chess.
Oh my gosh.
That's so good.
That's my favorite thing.
Isn't that great? It's like, just distract them. Hey, look, there's a squirrel.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so books analyzing a few basic opening moves, elementary middle game combinations.
Wait, what would that even do?
I don't know. It's like throwing them off that they can't concentrate or something or see the board as well. I don't know.
The whole point of chess is like you memorize all the like possible moves. So it's like,
I know. That's...
You can't trick someone. You can't just be, like, switching pieces or...
But see, back then, because, like, he was talking...
Oh,
like,
gosh.
That's why they were saying that, like, the chess theory at that time was so primitive. Like,
I know.
They're only starting out with the real, like, writing down the strategy and starting to memorize the moves and stuff.
That.
I know. Isn't that hilarious? Ugh. Okay, so books analyzing a few basic opening moves, elementary middle game combinations, and simple elements of end game technique appeared as early as the 15th century. So now they're starting to dig into the different elements of the game. So, you know, if you look at, like, everybody agrees that there's, like, the opening moves that mm-hmm. set the tone for a certain thing. There's the middle game, so how you're going to play your middle game, like, the middle mm-hmm. part of your game, how you're going to end it, all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's specific theories being formed about each part of the game now. About around 1620, an Italian master, Gioacchino Greco, wrote an analysis of a series of composed games that illustrated two contrasting approaches to chess.
Ooh.
Greco is regarded as the first chess professional and had considerable influence in popularizing chess and in showing that there were different theories about how it should be played. So this is where he's starting to, like, analyze the games, which is now what you see in chess books and everything. Everybody analyzes all these old mm-hmm. games and they go back to it because they're writing it down as it happens.
Right.
Which, if you remember back, the Chaturanga back in India, they didn't make notes or anything about any of the games.
Dang.
But so as we go through history, it's starting to be specifically written down and recorded so that other people can read it and learn from it now.
Yeah. Dang.
So the first coordinated explanation of how chess games are won came in the 18th century from François-André Philidor of France. Philidor, he was a composer of music. He was regarded as the world's best chess player for nearly 50 years.
Whoa!
In 1749, Philidor wrote and published a book that I'm going to translate into Chess Analyzed, because I can't say it in the French.
No problem.
It's an enormously influential book that appeared in more than 100 editions at the time that it was written.
Whoa.
So Philidor used apparently fictitious games to illustrate his principles for conducting a strategic rather than tactical battle.
Mm.
But it was Philidor's middle game advice that was his greatest legacy. He emphasized the role of planning and also placed a premium on anticipating enemy threats rather than merely concentrating on one's own attack. So he kind of focused on, like, learning the whole game, not just learning what you were going to do, but also being able to predict what your opponent was going to do.
Right.
From 1750 to 1769, a group of masters from Modena, Italy? I don't know, someplace. I think I spelled it wrong.
I think Modena? Or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so, something like that.
A group of masters from there, they criticized Philidor's ideas. By analyzing the play of 16th century Italian masters, the Modena school showed that games could be won in fewer than 20 moves through speedy piece mobilization compared with Philidor's slow developing pawn marches. Excuse me. there followed a proliferation of speculative pawn sacrifices in the opening called gambits in order to achieve rapid mobilization and open lines for an attack. Cool. This method of playing became the hallmark of many players from the 19th century and became known as the Romantic era of chess. So in the 19th century, because everything, as we talked about before, in that the 1800s there is like the Romantic era generally, but it also was the Romantic era of chess because
That's
they started
funny.
Sacrificing all of these things in order to win the game as a whole.
Gosh,
they realized
they
had to lose certain things, right?
Yeah, not this like steady, slow pace kind of military march, but like this romantic tale of like, you know,
exactly.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So it's interesting thinking that like even in the 1750s, I mean, Philidor was writing his stuff, right? 1749. He wrote and published that book.
Yeah.
And this other group of masters already exists and they have their own theories. Like it just shows how pervasive chess was in everything that people were studying it already at that early time.
Yeah, Oh my gosh, that's crazy. And not just playing it in that kind of folk way of like most card games, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of card games, like just finding rules is really hard because you'll play, learn some game from like your parents or something. And then you're like, okay, like I've had it a couple times where your mom actually taught us a game.
And that penny one.
The penny one.
Yeah.
And I was trying to Google, I couldn't find anything. And then
that
if you try
so
to look
fun.
Up certain, like Rummy, they all have different names, they all have different rules, and it's kind of infuriating, right? But how nice is it that, like, chess that has, like, the regional styles, like you were saying at first, but then you could just hone it and be like, this is
chess.
Exactly.
And there's so much out there, and because they started recording the games, like, I also can't think of that they have, maybe Bridge is maybe comparable in that way, but there aren't that many games out there where they're like, okay, you know, we're recording it so that you can go back and study old games, right?
Yeah. And other games are kind of more simple, like
maybe
poker.
Because other games have an element of luck or chance to it, right? Like you're going to pick certain cards, so you can't necessarily predict it in the same way.
This reminds me of the Rubik's Cube chess, I mean, because it's all algorithms. Like my nephew, he's like, I can teach you how to solve this cube, and I've never solved a cube before. And I was like, okay. And so he was like, okay, L whatever and L1 and this and this. And so I was doing these steps and I ended up getting like one thing solved. And
no
he
way.
Just memorized this whole algorithm. And I was like,
crazy.
What? And that's all it is, really.
Yeah.
And chess, like, I'm a little bit a jerk. I think it's all a memorization game.
I think at this point now, though,
chess.
It is, right? Where, and it's being, I think, being able to see, like, depending on what they come back with, and you're like, okay, then I need to do this. If they do this, then I do this, or whatever.
I think it's
right?
an amazing mental game. Yeah. I don't think you have to be a genius to play it.
Oh, totally. No, no.
You just need lots of time.
Exactly. You just need to study it like anything else, right?
Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Okay, so the 19th century saw chess gaining popularity, and people started to hold competitions.
Wow. Only then?
Yeah. Yeah, so in the 1800s, yeah. So the first major international event was a series of six matches held in 1834 between the leading French and British players.
Ooh.
So they were Louis Charles de la Bourdonnais of Paris and Alexander MacDonald of London, which ended with the French guy winning.
Oh,
for the first time, a major chess event was reported extensively in newspapers and analyzed in books.
Oh, that'd be so fun.
I know, right?
For people.
Howard Staunton won a match in 1843, which garnered a lot of international attention and also helped to introduce the idea of stakes competition because he won £100 that had been put up by supporters of the two players. By winning the game, he ended up winning, like, the pot, basically.
Yeah.
So Staunton used his position as the unofficial world champion to popularize a new board pattern set, promote a uniform set of rules, and to organize the first international tournament, which was held in London in 1851. Before this time, chess sets weren't uniform at all, so they could look totally different.
Oh.
Like the pieces looked different and whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, like the set as a whole, so the board and the pieces and everything.
But it wasn't like there was like an 8x8 versus like...
No.
3x3, whatever.
Okay. No. Yeah, like they were all the same size, but they looked different. Like they had different things. So in 1849, Jacques of London, a manufacturer of games and toys, introduced a new style of pieces created by Nathaniel Cook. These pieces were endorsed by Howard Staunton. And keep in mind, at this time, he's like super famous, the highest level chess player guy, and became known as the Staunton pattern. And these pieces became instantly popular because he was one of the most popular players at the time, and they were used in tournaments and clubs all over the world. The Staunton pieces and minor variations of it are still considered to be the standard for tournament chess sets. And they're basically the sets that you and I are familiar with the little pawn, with the little ball on the top, and like the classic thing that you think of with chess.
My dad had his old pattern. Chess set, and my sister got it. I'm furious because I think it's gone now. And I'm like, no! I was so obsessed with that set.
Oh my gosh. I know. We used to play chess with my dad when I was a kid all the time.
I never played.
I used to be pretty good at it when I was really little.
Damn. Which I tried teaching myself recently and my brain doesn't like, well, like long distance strategy. It just does not. I'm good at like short, like remember Sorry, the board game? That's like mini strategy almost.
Yeah. But as soon as low level strategy is good.
How dare you? I play the game Sorry to a high level.
You did kick my butt, you bastard. That was fun. We used to have Sorry tournaments where we each would play two colors at a time, and it would be like this master. So it wasn't just the basic game. We like elevated it to this like intense rivalry.
We did. It was
pretty good.
But if I tried chess, I'd be like, I'm out.
Yeah. I don't know.
No patience on my end.
I don't have patience with it either. I have patience with other games like Settlers of Catan. I love
because
Carcassonne.
You can, it's like a slow build sort of.
Yeah. It's strategy in a different way.
You're right. Yeah. Because there was a card game, I forgot which one, I won all the time when we played, like in this group thing I was in. And I just like obliterated people. And they were like, how are you doing that? I'm like, but it's just like how my brain works.
Yeah.
But not chess,
but for some reason chess doesn't, So the 19th century also marked the introduction of chess clocks to competitive play.
Ooh.
In the 19th century. Kind of around the same time that all this other stuff is developing, like mid-1800s.
Right, okay.
Before chess clocks became the norm, a single game could last up to 14 hours. With the standardization of chess sets and introduction of chess clocks, the equipment needed for modern matches and tournaments were set in place. So now tournaments started becoming a much bigger deal.
Wait, but can't games still last forever, or you had a time limit with this clock?
So I
don't know how that works.
The clocks, they have a time limit of like you can do, say, 24 moves in a 2 hour time span or whatever. Because they had, as the clocks were being developed, it was like they actually went through a lot of different iterations of the clocks because at first they were like, okay, like you have a certain amount of time, but some turns are very quick and some turns take longer to think.
So I think what they ended up doing was
giving each player like the 2 hours. So if you've got a couple of really fast turns because you know the strategy is very basic and it takes you 1 second or 2 seconds to do it, but then you can take longer on another turn and think about it a bit longer.
Never even gave thought to that blasted
clock. Oh my gosh,
like what it does!
I know that
I'm so dumb.
Same, and that was like a whole other rabbit hole to go down because it was like this elaborate thing, and these people went back and forth, and these people argued this and all this kind of stuff. So every little part of this has all these other people weighing in on how to standardize certain things.
Oh
right?
Oh my gosh.
So there were a bunch of unofficial world championships happening at this time, but the first official chess world championship took place in 1886 and was won by William Steinitz.
Okay.
Okay.
That name sounds familiar.
Yeah, it did. It sounded familiar to me too.
Yeah.
So that's...
Side note, sorry, really quick. Yeah. Just when you said that they have like these unofficial ones, I thought of that IT Crowd episode where there's like that official TV game show Countdown
that was one of my favorite episodes ever.
And then there was like the street countdown.
Oh my gosh. Yes. That's exactly it.
Street chess.
Okay, so that's kind of where I leave it for, like, the origins, because of course we know that all this stuff happens afterwards, and it's evolving and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I was going to delve into how the championships worked, because they're kind of intense, like, but I didn't do that. So now I just have a bunch of fun facts that will cover some of the other stuff that we commonly associate with chess, too.
I love it.
Okay, so fun fact. Separation of the sexes in chess dates from about 1500 with the introduction of the queen. Chess became a much faster, more exciting game, and thus came to be perceived as a more masculine pursuit. Women were often barred from the coffee houses and taverns where chess clubs developed in the 19th century. However, women players achieved distinction separately from men by the middle of the century. The first chess clubs specifically for women were organized in the Netherlands in 1847.
Nice.
It's so crazy, though, that it's like, before that, it seems like women probably could play, and then...
I know.
They're like, no, no, it's too fast-paced for your women brains. Maybe men just didn't want to be beaten by us or something.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, fun fact. Paul Morphy was the first American recognized as the world's best player. Morphy's chess career lasted less than 3 years. It lasted less than 3 years and consisted of fewer than 75 serious games. In 1858 to 59, he defeated all the leading European players, with the disappointing exception of Howard Staunton, who evaded all attempts to arrange a match. So the only reason he couldn't beat him was because he wouldn't play him. Yeah.
Well, he has all that money, right? Like,
yeah, he had a lot to lose by not playing him. Yeah. So that seems to be a big thing in chess, too, is that they can... So that's why I didn't really delve into how they figure out the championships, because it sounded like the winner of a championship, a world championship, they dictate, like, the... when the next championship is going to happen, where it's happening. Like, they dictate the rules and everything of the next championship. And so some people would put off planning it. Like, they wouldn't do it so that they could remain the champion for longer.
Oh.
So there is a bit of a thing of, like, there was a lot of people kind of using their power to not play certain people, you know, because they wanted to remain the high up, which is exactly what happened here.
That's cowardly.
I know.
It should be, you know, a forced thing, like every year, or whatever. But then,
I think it is not allowed in certain situations. But that's why I didn't delve into it too much, because there was a lot of differing information about it.
Yeah, there's a whole history, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but it sounded like that's not uncommon in the chess world, that they can kind of leverage some control instead of it being a standardized thing of every year. If you want to keep that title or keep that thing, if you want to be a part of it, you have to compete so we can actually see who's best, kind of thing.
Just come back next year and beat the guy.
Like, exactly. Okay, so at the age of 22, Morphy retired from serious chess, and he remains the only great chess thinker who left no written legacy. So he didn't write down his games. He didn't write down any stuff. He didn't write any chess theory, nothing. So he was very much almost this guy who was, like, really good at it for a few years, beat the crap out of everybody, and was like, okay, see ya. Like, I'm off to something else. Like, didn't really care about the politics of it. Didn't really care about, you know, what everybody else was doing at the time, right?
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Oh my gosh, that's funny.
Okay, so my last fun fact is to just talk about the three memorable chess games in history.
Okay.
So these are commonly written about that as, like, they were pivotal kind of chess games that happened.
Yeah. So Bobby Fischer!
You betcha. He's coming up next. But the first one is called the Immortal Game. So the so-called Immortal Game was between the German master, well, they're both German, so between the German masters Adolf Anderssen and Lionel Kieseritzky. They defined the Romantic era of daring gambits and aggressive attacking. So the game was an informal game, actually, that was played in 1851 during a break from a formal tournament in London.
Oh, man.
In this game, Anderssen won despite sacrificing his bishop, both rooks, and the queen. And he got the checkmate even though Kieseritzky had only lost three pawns. So Keith Zeritsky had most of his pieces were still on the board.
That's insane.
Anderson was able to get the checkmate. Even with that. So people were saying, like, in this thing that I read, they were like, yeah, it was this informal game that wasn't even a part of any tournament. And everybody was gathering, and it went down, like, in history that people were like, this, it was unheard of. They had never seen anything like it before.
I love that story. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, now comes the game of the century. In 1956, at the age of 13... future world champion Bobby Fischer demonstrated his improvisational mastery in a game against Donald Byrne, who was a leading chess master of the day. This game was notable for several daring sacrifices, including an ingenious queen sacrifice that Fischer turned into deadly strategic advantages. Fischer went on to become the youngest grandmaster at the age of 15 in 1958.
Oh my gosh.
And won the world championship in 1972 against Boris Spassky in Iceland. Mm-hmm. Bobby is considered one of the greatest chess players of all time. And also, fun fact on top of that, is that when you and I went to Iceland, we stayed in the hotel where they had that game in 1972. And we went and they have like a little thing set up of the chess board and like a kind of a little museum nook about it. It was so cool
to be in the spot. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Side note, there was a documentary about that,
that was
thing.
So good.
And it's really good. And it shows the sad decline of Bobby Fischer and his mental state. But also, really quick, I want to encourage people to read, what Malcolm Gladwell book was it? With the 10,000 hours. I already forgot. Anyway, everyone's hearing about the 10,000 hours theory now with Malcolm Gladwell. He wrote a book, but...
Tipping Point? Or is that a different one? I don't know.
Or is
anyway.
It... Maybe. Anyway, but it's know. The... I think... Yeah, and then he... But he uses Bobby Fischer as an example. And
Oh, really?
I'm pretty sure that was the thing where he
said, right, like, he... Yeah, yeah.
You know, everyone, like, they just call him a genius, but he was just trying to argue that, like, Bobby Fischer had the time and he was allowed to play this game that he was obsessed with.
Yeah.
And so, he had like no social life, nothing. He could just do this.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what led to him being so great at it, right? So it's not like he was some kind of like chess savant or whatever, really.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just the hours and hours and hours of playing a game that he loved, right?
Well, and that's the thing. I think that some people's like ability to singularly focus on certain things too is like... Mm-hmm. Is what keeps them doing that thing for so long. Like, that's very much how Greg's brain works, where he is like, if he has a goal or he has something that he's super into, like, he can seriously do that thing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Like, he will get it. If he didn't have to live life and, you know, do anything else, he easily could have sat there.
I think
and,
most of us are capable of stuff like that, right? You know, like, I will... like do something, like even something as simple as a video game. Like, do you remember the old Mario? It was the only video game we had, Super Mario, not the only game, but one of the few games. It was my favorite game. So I played Super Mario Brothers 3.
Oh my gosh.
Over and over and over. And if you put me in the game now, I can still do speed runs because it's just automatic.
It's just automatic. You just know how to do it. It's like riding a bike.
And my nephew will be like, wow, how are you so good? I'm like, yeah, but put me in a new Mario game.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hopeless.
That's so true, though. It really is being able to do it. Okay, and then the very last game that everybody talks about is Kasparov versus Deep Blue, Game 6. So in 1996 and 1997, Kasparov, then the world champion, played a series of matches against the IBM supercomputer named Deep Blue. Although Kasparov won the 1996 match, a much improved version of Deep Blue used an ingenious knight sacrifice to force Kasparov to resign in less than 20 moves. The result was the first victory by a computer over a reigning world champion, which obviously leads to, like, you know, questions of AI and all this kind of stuff of, like, can we learn and adjust?
I'm so amazed by that. Like, in hindsight, I'm kind of sitting here thinking, like, I was, like, so into that whole drama back in the day, and I'm like, it's a computer, of course it's gonna.
But I think it's also because of, like, how you've talked about already, that we have a perception that chess has some kind of innate, you know, you have to be some kind of genius or see things on a higher level or have something. But really, it's a mathematical, strategic thing.
It is. Yeah.
You know, so it seems computers would be perfectly suited to be able to do that because they can counter any of those strategies quickly. Right?
Yeah. Because it can... rapid fire have all the...
But I think because the idea, the perception we have of chess as this high-level thinkers, deep thinkers thing, we don't think that it makes sense that, oh my gosh, a computer could beat a person? Whoa, that's crazy. That's remember the movie
stupid.
War Games?
Oh, God,
back
I love
in the
that
day,
movie,
like,
though.
There we go. That's so, it's such a good movie. But that was very much like the thought process at that time where we were like,
no, you're right.
How could a computer possibly know? It's like, oh, it's just, it's simple strategy. It's just a basic, like, there's no luck or like fluke or anything. It's simply, if you move here, then I'm going to move there. And if then they do that, then I'll do that. It's like if statements, right? It's the psychology of logic.
Yeah.
If this, then that. And
oh
that is the origin of chess.
Okay, well, that was just so entertaining and crazy.
I had no idea. India, chaturanga. I had no idea that when I saw it, I was like, this can't be right. Is it pronounced differently? Like, I looked up how to pronounce it. They're like, no, it's the same as the yoga move. I'm like, oh my gosh,
Google
no
just
way.
Says that to you? No,
yeah,
it's the same.
Basically.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. Yay.
That was
so All right,
so
guys.
Good.
Thanks for listening. Remember to like, subscribe, and review. It really helps us out. You can also follow us on Instagram. We are at podcast.or.something. Or you can write to us if you want to send us an email. You can do so at podcast.or.something@gmail.com. And we will talk to you later. Or something. Bye.
Bye.